He was a morbidly obese surgeon destined for an operating table and an early death. Now he's a rebel MD who is fabulously fit and fighting to make America healthy again. This is Stay Off My Operating Table with Dr. Philip Ovadia.
All right, folks, it's the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. Dr. Philip Ovadia, I'm Jack Heald, and we've got today probably the tallest, whitest, strongest guest we've ever had.
Introduce yeah, I don't think there's any Phil. Doubt about that.
Could be.
Real honored to have Sean Baker with us today. I doubt that I need to really introduce him to any of our audience, but Sean literally wrote the book on the carnivore diet, I think has been one of the major forces behind the resurgence of the carnivore diet. Certainly was one of my early introductions to it as well. And I've been honored to work along Sean and speak along him now for a number of years. So with that, Sean, why don't you just give maybe a little brief backstory as to how you came to the carnivore diet?
Yeah, well, like probably most of us, you know, I'm now in my sort of late 50s, and you know, somewhere in my 40s, I realized that my health had started to take a turn for the worse. I guess aging. I mean, as most of us sort of come to the realization that, hey, I'm not 20 anymore, and experiencing what I thought were the normal symptoms and signs of aging, which included, you know, poor sleep, gaining weight, I had, in retrospect, I had many of the signs and symptoms of metabolic syndrome, metabolic disease. And I didn't like that particularly. I mean, I was a physician. I thought as a physician, you think you have some special immunity to health problems, which we don't, as we realize physicians just as much as anyone else are susceptible to the same things everybody else is. I was an athlete, so I thought that, you know, maybe, you know, just training hard would protect me from some of that. And I mean, arguably it did to some degree, but certainly I was experiencing, you know, the eventual, where I was here, you can't outrun a bad diet. And, you know, I think you can for a little while, but then it catches up to you. And I think some people it catches up very quickly, and other people are able to avoid it for a number of years. And so I think I was around 40, mid, you know, 42, 43, I started to realize that I needed to start to look into nutrition a little more aggressively, and not just rely on being able to out exercise things. And so with that, I embarked on about a 7-8 year journey of playing with different nutritional strategies. And the first thing I did was what I thought was the right thing, just dramatically cut calories, exercise more, eat a very low fat diet. And that actually did allow me to lose some weight. But the problem with that is I was miserable. I mean, I remember all the nurses in the office and the people I work with, that we much liked you when you were fatter, you know, because you were a nicer person. And I was hungry and I was angry and just, I just didn't like that. So I sort of evolved the diet into more of a paleo style of diet, which was more sustainable for me. And then eventually started looking into the literature kind of critically and reading some of the stuff that was available at the time. And I ended up on a more of a low carb approach. And that eventually pushed me personally towards a, you know, fully meat-based carnivorous approach. And during that journey, I started to apply lower carb diets to my patients, you know, orthopedic surgery patients who, interestingly, you know, the ones that would do it, many of them lost weight. But the thing that really struck me as interesting was the fact that these patients who I had on the schedule, on the operating room schedule for knee replacement, hip replacement, different large surgical procedures, came back and said, I don't have any pain anymore. And I thought that was really sort of surprising to me, that someone who has
before surgery.
This is before surgery. This is someone with, you know, clear radiographic and clinical symptomatic signs that would indicate, you know, you need a knee replacement, you failed all the other non-operative, or minimally, knee arthroscopy type things, injections. You failed all those things, and now the only thing left we can do for you is replace your joint. And they came back and said, I don't have any pain anymore. And I was like, well, if you don't have pain anymore, there's no indication for the indication for surgery is no longer there for the most part. So we ended up canceling a lot of surgeries, which I thought was pretty cool, quite honestly. But back to my own.
So you were helping people stay off the operating table before Phil was helping people to stay.
Well, I mean, in a way, I guess, I don't know. I mean, Phil, I don't know, whenever you wake up as a surgeon, you wake up to the fact that lifestyle, diet, nutrition, sleep, exercise can actually do a tremendous amount more than we've been told they can, I think we are vastly undertrained in nutrition as allopathic medical providers. And I think that's intentional. Honestly, I think looking back for it, it's like, well, why do you want to spend time doing that when you've got all these wonderful pharmaceutical inventions that you can utilize, or these procedural things, which also drive a lot of pharmacy. I mean, there's no surgery you can do without pharmaceutical drugs, right? I mean, we know that. I mean, all the anesthetic drugs, the postoperative pain drugs, the preoperative, postoperative antibiotics, the blood thinners. I mean, even though it's a surgery, there's still a tremendous amount of pharmacy that goes into that. So, so you're not really trained in it. You don't really know. I mean, you don't really get much, you get the basics of, this is a vitamin deficiency, and you never expect to see that again in the rest of your career. I mean, I don't know how many times you've treated pellagra or beriberi or, scurvy. I mean, you never see it. I mean, you just don't ever see it in Western medicine. So it's kind of like, well, why did I even learn about that stuff? I mean, it's kind of like, I guess it was just sort of a gratuitous, touching the bases, say you had a little bit of nutrition, but we don't really get much. And my journey into carnivore was strictly selfish. I wanted to be better physically, health-wise for myself. I didn't have any altruistic reason for doing it other than I just wanted to be a better athlete, really. I mean, I was like, I'd already been low carb, and I was like, I think this can make me a better athlete. And it did. And it ultimately turned out that it, made me stronger, recover better, train harder, so on and so forth. And so that's kind of how I got into this. But I mean, along the way of trying to fix myself, I realized that there's broader applicability towards, a large segment of population that we, as physicians are tasked to treat. And I think we, in some cases, underperform. I mean, like I said, if I'm having a heart attack, yeah, I want somebody like Phil that can do something. Or if I am in a car crash and my femur's sticking out through, the front of the windshield, you're not going to treat that with diet. But I mean, short of that, much of what we do can be treated with, diet, lifestyle, all those types of things that we all understand now as a group.
Yeah, and I think even more powerful than the treatment is the prevention, that we stop people from getting there in the first place. Because, when you're having the heart attack, diet and lifestyle isn't going to help you. But if we stop you from having the heart attack with diet and lifestyle, that's a major win that we just don't focus on enough.
Yeah. I mean, when I would like do someone's knee replacement and they would have a good outcome and they're like, hey, Dr. Baker, thank you. My knee feels better and great. And then they would come back 2 or 3 years later for their other knee to be replaced. Mm-hmm. And that was, I would kind of pat myself on the back. Hey, look, I did a good job. They trust me to do another surgery on them. But in retrospect, I kind of let that patient down because I probably could have given them advice so they could have avoided that second requirement, had I known, 10 years ago, I would have avoided the first knee replacement in many cases. And likewise, the people you've done, bypass grafting on, you probably could have, if you could have gotten to them 10 years earlier, they might have not needed that. And I know that's what you're trying to focus on now. And we all, as physicians that have kind of made that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, but the reason you came to this conclusion is because you looked into your own health, same just like I did. And probably most of the physicians out here, except every treatment had to come to their own their own sort of.
Sean, hang on a minute. Right? We got a bad connection there with you. Say that last sentence again. We lost you.
I think what I was saying is that most of the physicians, and probably all the physicians that I can think of, that have come to this sort of realization that lifestyle is important, have come to it through a journey of their own health. It wasn't that they said, well, these patients need lifestyle. It was you had to first experience it yourself. And I think that's what pretty much most of us doing this now have come to that realization. And so a lot of the, you know, you see these, a lot of these people that are just freshly minted physicians that are, you know, 30 years of age and are like, well, I'm, you know, we've got all these new powerful drugs and medication. But I think, you know, you talk to them when they're 40, when they're 50, when they're 60, and they've kind of, you know, realize that, hey, you still gotta address the lifestyle stuff.
Yeah. Thankfully, I think we are starting to see some younger physicians kind of wake up to this, but even them, you know, many of them have had their own struggles, that kind of, brought them to this. But, you know, I think we're starting to change that, at least with some of the conferences and getting some of this information out there. So, you know, you now certainly, I would say, lead probably the largest community of carnivore dieters. And I think it would be great to get into a little of the advanced stuff. You know, I think much of our audience knows about carnivore, knows the basics of it. But I'd love to touch a little bit on, like, you know, the 400 level carnivore diet. What are some of the challenges that you see people having, and maybe we can start getting into some of the maybe not obvious conditions that show improvement with carnivore diets as well. But let's start with, like, what are some of the common challenges that within your community come up for people doing the carnivore diet?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that the nice things about it is it's a very simple diet. I mean, it doesn't require a lot of calculation and, you know, planning. It's, you know, hey, I pull a steak out of the freezer and eat it, you know, and so that works for many of the people. And there's something like that. But what I've seen over time is, you know, there seems to be some people where certain, I guess, habits tend to work better than others. I mean, I think one of the biggest things, you know, when you're thinking about, you know, a carnivore diet is, you know, it's a lot of meat, basically. And there's not much to it. I mean, there's protein and fat for the most part. And so some people get into how much fat should I consume? How much quantity of food should I consume? Am I, you know, what am I trying to solve with this issue? And so I think for what I like to talk about is a lot of people that come to this with the baggage of addiction, you know, food addiction in a lot of cases. You know, it's usually not that they were eating too many broccoli salads that got them obese. It was usually because they were eating the ubiquitous human, you know, pet food, I like to call it, that's out there that tastes great. And it's incredibly addicting, and it's cheap, and it's ubiquitous. And, you know, it's like, how do you get away from that? You know, that's step one, I think, you know, because I think, you know, any person that can remove that stuff from their diet for a period of time will often benefit. And that's why we see success with really anything that's not the standard American diet. And what I find is, so initially for those people, I tell them, you just got to eat enough so you don't want that stuff. Cause they're like, well, how much this and that should I eat? And I think step one is just you eat enough so you don't want the cupcakes or the pizzas or the whatever your Oreo cookies or whatever your demon is. And so that's, I think that helps people for the first few months. And then we get into, what are you treating? You know, because I think we've gotten pretty comfortable about treating diabetes with nutrition. I mean, I think most of us will agree that, hey, I can go on a low carb diet and I can improve my glycemic control. And that makes sense from a just basic physiology standpoint. But then you start looking at why are people with autoimmune conditions getting better? Why are people with mental health issues getting better, or neurodegenerative diseases in many cases, or neurologic diseases getting better? And I think you start to see there's different things at play there besides just how many carbs you're exposed to. And so I think that's something that I see in particular. You know, I see some people where they just eat mounds and mounds of fat, which can sometimes be counterproductive in some cases. I mean, we see people, they just, they're told, hey, I'm supposed to be eating sticks of butter with my food, you know, like the old ketogenic diet where you had people that were, you know, putting all this fat on everything. And I think it's beneficial for a subset of the population. I think people with neurologic and, you know, mental health issues, that seems to be that they do better a little bit on a higher fat side of things, at least for a period of time. It may not be a permanent situation, but if we look at things like, for instance, MS, and we've had a lot of success with multiple sclerosis, which is a horrible, horrible disease, you know, particularly as it progresses and a lot of people die early from it. And it's a significant problem with quality of life. We know that from both animal and human studies that it is almost impossible to remyelinate damaged nerves. And one of the hallmarks of multiple sclerosis is a demyelination that occurs. And so myelin is the kind of the insulation that kind of surrounds the nerve endings. It's made out of, you know, fat basically. And so we know that, you know, animal studies show that without exogenous cholesterol, and the only place you can get exogenous cholesterol or dietary cholesterol is in animal products, you know, animal cell walls, not cell walls, cell membranes have cholesterol, as which plant walls, cell walls don't. And so that's one of the hallmark differences between animal food and plant food is the presence of cholesterol. And we've been told for, you know, gosh, 50 years, oh, cholesterol is bad for you, you know. And then, you know, 2015, the US dietary guidelines said, hey, dietary cholesterol is not the problem. It doesn't seem to have an impact on our serum cholesterol, which is a whole nother topic, which Phil, I'm sure you've explored, you know, ad nauseum probably at this point. But so we see that, like, for instance, MS, I have a number of MS people that we see, and they almost universally do better on a skewed higher fat approach for a period of time. So that's different. Whereas, you know, you might see someone with, you know, obesity is their main concern. They may not need so much fat. I mean, fat is certainly important. And you know, when I say low fat, I'm talking like 60% of your calories are coming from low fat. I mean, in the context of a carnivore diet, I mean, you know, I eat a ribeye steak and people will say, oh, that's a lot of protein. But, you know, in reality, 60, 75% of those calories are coming from fat. So I'm eating, you know, what I consider moderate fat for a carnivore diet, whereas there's people that skew where they're 80, 85, maybe even 90% of their calories come from fat. And these are the people that have neurodegenerative problems, MS, you know, some of the mood disorders where they tend to require that at least for a period of time. And it might be a few years even. And then they start sort of kind of normalize to what I think is a, you know, 60 to 80% of your calories coming from fat, which I think seems to be the spot for most people. It's pretty hard to, you know, survive on 50% or less fat in the context without carbohydrates. Now, you had carbohydrates in the mix, and certainly you can bring that number down. And I don't, you know, again, even though I'm a proponent of a carnivore diet, I don't think everybody needs to be doing that. You know, I think many people, one thing I will say is meat is, I think, a health food. I think it's an improperly vilified, you know, demonized food that we should have never done that. We should, you know, whenever that happened, you know, 1914 or 1917, when the American Dietetic Association was formed by the Seventh-day Adventists, or when Eisenhower had his heart attack in the 50s, despite the fact that he was smoking 3 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day, or, you know, whatever, Ansel Keys, or the U.S. dietary guidelines, you know, with George McGovern, blah, 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 whatever that was. I mean, I think it was incorrectly done. And I think we've been suffering the consequences of that ever since that time. Some of the other things, I mean, I think women, just like men, women versus men, I think women, again, maybe skew a little bit more slightly higher fat. So maybe instead of 60% calories, they need 65% of their calories from fat. Women are fatter than men. I mean, that's just one of the realities of the differences in the sexes. Women carry more body fat for men, and there's reasons for that. You know, maybe they have more developed brains. I don't know. Jokingly, but
there you go.
They would probably fess to that. But I mean, it's interesting because, you know, what's interesting, if you look at the difference between human physiology and dog, in like dogs is another example. You know, I have dogs and I feed them a carnivore diet. Dogs, there's actually interesting, there's feeding studies on dogs where they self-select foods. They self-select their macronutrients, and they'll put fat, protein, and carbs down. And dogs initially will eat a high-fat diet, a relatively high-fat diet, something like 67, 70% fat. And then after a week or so of that, they'll automatically revert to a much leaner diet. And the reason for that, and they'll consume almost no carbohydrate. The reason for that is because, you know, a dog's brain size is much smaller than ours. I mean, it's just, you know, for its body size, a dog has a very, you know, like a brain the size of kind of like a walnut, or, you know, maybe slightly a large walnut, whereas we have, you know, brain that's, you know, 2.5-3 pounds or something like that, 20%, or sorry, 2% of our mass, but, you know, 20 something percent of our energy production goes to our brain. So it's interesting. Those are some of the things I've seen. Some of the other things that I think are a little more, maybe not the average person sees, because like I said, I've been doing this now for, gosh, 7 years. And I literally spent every single day of my life meeting with people on this diet and seeing what works for them, what doesn't work for them, what's unique about them. You know, I think there's differences, like I said, like I mentioned, between men and women. I think there's differences between, you know, the age, you know, and the athletic, you know, maybe the desires of the particular person. I am a very protein centric person. That is, I think protein is incredibly important. I think just in general across the board, Americans don't get enough protein. I think the RDA is woefully, abysmally too low. I mean, it's a bare minimum, not to basically fall apart, you know, with the 0.8 per kilogram. And so I tend to push for more protein in the context. And then I also try to push people to exercise and maintain lean mass and put on lean mass, regardless of age and sex and other things. And so I think, again, you might have to, you know, in the absence of carbohydrates, you know, because we talk about the fact that, you know, low carbohydrates in general tend to drive insulin secretion down to a degree. You know, we know that, you know, certainly carbohydrates are pretty good at causing insulin release. We know that protein kind of has a moderate effect, and fat tends to be a little less, you know, it tends to be fairly low with regard to that. And so one of the things we know that carbohydrates and insulin can do, there seems to be no advantage to adding carbohydrates to protein when it comes to muscle protein synthesis, but there may be some advantage when it comes to muscle protein breakdown. So if you don't have carbohydrates, you might have to eat protein over and above that for muscle protein synthesis, over above what was, which, you know, if you talk to guys like Don Lehman, Stu Phillips, and some of the other big names in protein, would recommend 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram. But then you see some people where their recommendations might be higher at 2.2, even as high as 2.6. And I think, again, as you drop the carbs, those numbers may go up.
All right. I've followed you so far, okay, but I've lost you here in the last couple of sentences.
Okay.
You talked about the difference between, I'm interpreting because I'm not the medical guy. Building muscle and keeping muscle from tearing down. I think that's the context we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
So there is, you know, when it comes to how much muscle you have, it's always a balance between how much you produce and how much you break down. You know, it just makes sense. There's some taking away, and our muscle turns over. About 1-2% of our muscle breaks down every day and turns over. So, I mean, we have that going on, and things can increase that or decrease that. Like we know, for instance, a heavy chronic endurance activity actually breaks down a lot of muscle. When you're out there running and pounding the pavement, a lot of your muscle breaks down. And so some of the new research has come out showing that if you're a low carbohydrate athlete and you're an endurance athlete, you need to up your protein percentage fairly significantly. So, I mean, these things have roles. Again, it depends.
So on with a higher carb diet as an endurance athlete, you suffer less muscle breakdown as a result of your high intensity, long duration. So am I interpreting?
So the carbohydrate has some advantage for limiting muscle protein breakdown, right? Doesn't really add much to protein on the synthesis side. So if you are reducing your carbohydrates, you may see increased breakdown, and therefore you might need to increase your protein to sort of, I guess, counterbalance that, I suppose. I think that's the way some of the current understanding works. And so that is to say, you know, an average, say, person, an athlete that's trying to put on muscle will eat X amount of protein and X amount of fat and X amount of carbohydrates and maybe optimize for putting on muscle. Whereas if you're not including carbohydrates in the diet, you might have to actually eat a little bit more protein than somebody who's eating carbohydrates. So carbohydrates don't necessarily promote any more muscle protein synthesis. They may just limit some of the breakdown. And so because of that, if your goal is to put on muscle in a low carb or a no carb position, you might have to just eat a little bit more protein beyond what a normal bodybuilder may have. Now, this also brings into the context of diabetes. I mean, this is another topic that, you know, you talk about some of the more advanced things. Diabetics, depending on the, you know, of course we have, you know, two major types, type ones and type twos. Of course, there's now the LADAs and the MODYs and some of the other subtypes of diabetes. And some people say there's up to five types of diabetes now. We see that for some of those folks, depending upon how much their beta cell, their pancreatic beta cells are putting out beta cells, or remember responsible for insulin, the alpha cells are putting out the glucagon. And so we have this sort of balance between, beta cell function or insulin secretion or insulin function, because insulin, the net effect of insulin is dependent upon, just like any other hormone, how much hormone is produced and then how sensitive the receptors are. So if you have, that's one of the hallmark problems with type 2 diabetes. We have, you know, maybe over secretion of insulin, but the receptors are so bad, you know, they're so resistant that the insulin doesn't work. So you have a net effective, not very effective insulin. And then glucagon still seems to be working pretty well. And so you have glucagon, which is trying to do the opposite of insulin. Glucagon is trying to make our blood glucose go higher by causing the liver to release glucagon and some of the other things. It's more catabolic. And so whereas insulin is making us store things, glucagon is making us release things. And so when you have a diabetic person that has a sort of an imbalance between, you know, insulin sensitivity and insulin function and glucagon, some of that extra protein can cause hyperglycemia. And so we see a lot of people where they go whatever low carb and they notice that, you know, oh my God, the protein is turning. This is the whole thing where the steak is turning into cake. You know, we've gotten this sort of thing. And, you know, we've got this, well, it's gluconeogenesis. And I think it's probably more glycogenolysis because, you know, you see.
Whoa. Okay. Slow down. Gluconeogenesis versus glucose something.
So gluconeogenesis, basically, you probably heard of that. It means making glucose from other compounds, usually, right. You know, glycerol from a triglyceride, or more commonly, we see it from amino acids. And some amino acids can be turned into glucose. Some of them can be turned into ketones, and many of them can be turned into both. So anyway, so gluconeogenesis, you know, I think what we see postprandially, because this is, you know, I classically see this where somebody chugs a protein shake, and we know that the amino acids from protein are very rapidly bioavailable. We're not designed to eat powders. I mean, this is a thing. If you look at how our digestive system is set up, we're not supposed to eat powders, whether it be flour or sugar or protein powder, or quite honestly, concentrated fats. So concentrated things like butter or cream or whatever oil, that's not what our human system is set up to do. Now we do that, and we can handle that to a degree, and people do all the time, but it's not like how we're ideally designed to make food, eat food. We're supposed to take a bite out of something, whether it's a piece of fruit or a nut or a big old hunk of, you know, the backside of a boar or something like that. Whatever we eat, it's got protein and fat bound in a matrix, and it goes into our stomach, which, you know, the average time in the stomach's about 4 hours is typically what gastric emptying time is. And that can be modulated by some of our incretin hormones, which can increase or delay that. And so we churn it and we break it down slowly. And then that food is basically slowly released into the first part of our small intestine called the duodenum. And so we have this slow release of food. But when we, you know, I think this is one of the things with processed foods. When we eat powdered food, whatever it is, you know, a cake is basically powdered food. It's been put back together, but it's still powder. And so the surface area is very small, and therefore the absorption capacity is very quick. And so, like, you know, you put whatever, it's sugar or protein powder or oil, into that system, and it really doesn't have to spend much time in the GI. It doesn't have to spend much time in the stomach, because the stomach's like, well, what am I doing? you're already broken down into the smallest component it can be. So our body, I think, senses that, and it's just dumped into our duodenum. So sometimes we can exceed the capacity to absorb that. So a lot of times we get malabsorption or steatorrhea or, you know, GI symptoms and so on and so forth. And so I think, again, with the, I guess I kind of wandered quite a far away.
Well, I'm digging it. As long as I'm understanding, I'm cool with it.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, you said gluconeogenesis versus gluco, and that's
glycogenolysis. So basically glycogenolysis is just a breakdown of glycogen. So you're familiar with glycogen. Glycogen is the storage form of glucose. We have it in primarily our liver and our muscles and some other cells. But I mean, mostly it's kind of a rapidly accessible form of stored energy, you know, whereas body fat is what we store around our belly and our butt. And glycogen is stored actually within the muscles themselves, within the liver itself. And so under the influence of glucagon and some of the other hormones, the cortisol, some of the catecholamines like norepinephrine, will cause that glycogen to break down so we have rapid availability for glucose. And why is that so important? It's because, you know, the fight or flight thing. You know, if we get all of a sudden we're walking through the forest and a bear pops out, we want to be able to run. You know, I mean, we've got this ATP system that allows us to expend energy for about 10 seconds. This is what true sprinting is. And so we've got this, you know, this sort of rapidly progressive way of, or, you know, a progressive way to expend energy or to move. And so the first thing is ATP, or the phosphagen system, or the creatine phosphate system. It's, you know, it's just pure ATP that breaks apart, right? And so we have that available to us so we can kind of react for about 5 to 10 seconds. You know, we can have this rapid fight or flight thing. And then we go on to what's called anaerobic glycolysis, where we start to use some of this glucose. And this is what happens when we dump that glucose from the liver, or the so-called glycogenolysis. So break the lysis of glycogen, glycogenolysis. So breaking down the glycogen that's in the liver to rapidly flood our blood supply with glucose. And so that is sort of the, I guess, some of the physiologic foundation upon why we do that. And then we get into this oxidative, oxygen using aerobic metabolism, where you can go run 20 miles or whatever you want to do. Really, those crazy people like to do that sort of stuff. But anyway, so those are, you know, some of the basic physiologic underpinnings on what's going on. And some of that, you know, some of that breaks down under these different pathophysiologic conditions like diabetes, where, you know, we have this system where we're really good at producing glucose. We still have the capacity to produce glucose. And it's interesting, if you look at some of the macronutrient studies on what causes blood glucose to rise. One is, you know, there's studies on protein. So, and I, you know, there's studies I've seen where they take protein and they feed people protein and they don't see glucose until a certain threshold. So if you feed somebody pure protein, and I think it was like 75 grams, and this is again based on the average size individual, all these you have to scale to people. I mean, you'll Phil probably knows the average human was supposed to be 70 kilos. You know, a lot of these studies are based on the 154-pound, 5'10" male, I think, was supposed to be average. Just now the average male is quite a bit bigger than that, you know, as far as at least weight is. I mean, but it used to be 70 kilos. And so I think a lot of the studies were normalized to that. So at 75 grams of pure protein, you'll start to dump glucose out of your liver. And it's because it stimulates glucagon, I guess. I think that's what's going on. I'm sure there's a lot of intermediate steps in there, but effectively that's what's happening. Now, if you have a diabetic, you know, who's got this sort of poorly functioning insulin side, because they're insulin resistant, or they're a type 1 diabetic where they just don't produce insulin. Either way, the effect of that is we don't have enough insulin function to overcome what's happening with glycogen and glucagon, which breaks down, you know, glycogen in the liver to dump in, and we get hyperglycemia. And that's so, and rather than that steak turning into cake and cause and being stored, you know, via gluconeogenesis, which it does occur, but I think it's a much slower process. You know, like I said, if we see, like for instance, If anybody wears a CGM and they eat a protein meal, and I've seen this because I've worn a CGM at times, and I'll, you know, carbohydrates, obviously, you know, you snarf down a Coke and some donuts, your blood glucose within about 30 to 45 minutes is shooting upwards, right? But if you eat a protein meal, and it depends how much fat is there, more fat means it's going to take longer. But if you eat a protein meal, you're not going to see that release of, you're not going to see that glucose rise until about 3, 4, 5, 6 hours afterwards. And why, and you know, I think some of that is because those nutrients are not even getting into the, they're not even getting into the system until that time. You know, like I said, it's sitting in the stomach, still in the stomach for 4 hours, maybe longer. You know, if you eat a big meal, you know, we have this, you know, one of these new things that people talk about, GLP-1 agonists or receptor agonists, which are the new drug class of drug, the Ozempics, the Wegovys and things like that. And that one of the effects of GLP-1 is to slow gastric emptying time so that the food stays in the stomach even longer. And we know we can do that with just food. I mean, food has an impact on GLP-1. That's why it's there. It wasn't there because it was waiting for a drug to be, you know, injected into us. It's there because it's supposed to respond to foods. And we know, like a big steak, for instance, will cause that gastric emptying time to slow down. And, you know, we have even slower, acquisition of nutrients. And so again, I think what's happening with the initial spike in blood glucose in diabetics is that, you know, and a lot of them have this, you know, insulin is secreted in two phases. There's a rapid phase and a delayed phase, and they have very poor phase one response. So, I mean, you know, normally you would see, you know, in normal physiology, you eat some food, the body senses that it's there, it releases some insulin. We even have a cephalic phase, which means the head phase of digestion. And so when we smell food, when we see, we start salivating, we secrete salivary amylase and salivary lipase. And then, you know, we start releasing hormones. And one of those could be glucagon. And then so glucagon will be in effect, but insulin is also being secreted. They usually kind of balance each other out, and our blood glucose is kind of stable. But in a diabetic, you have this release of a poor release of insulin because the phase one response is broken or blunted, but we still have the glucagon response. And so we start seeing early on this rise in blood glucose with exposure to macronutrients, whether it be carbs or often protein. Anyway, that's kind of off. I guess it's kind of a weird diversion.
So that was a master class in physiology from the orthopedic surgeon that,
I like Phil. I got to tell you, my favorite class in all of medical was actually physiology. I really enjoyed that class. I really enjoyed that. Even though I ended up doing orthopedics, but I remember I was like, I really was fascinated by the physiology, and it's still, some of the stuff is just, it's just interesting how the body works. And,
yeah, how relevant it turns out to be. So yeah. What's your take on different protein sources? You know, people doing carnivore diet, you know, beef versus eggs versus non-ruminant animals.
Right. I think that, obviously animal foods, you know, versus plant food, animal foods tend to be complete. You know, I mean, you know, we know that. I mean, you know, you can cobble together a plant-based diet and get kind of an approximation of the essential macronutrients, but within the scope of the animal foods, I mean if you look at things like the PDCAAS and the DIAS, these are ways to measure how much protein.
The what?
Something, it's called the PDCAAS is protein digestibility corrected amino acid score. It's just a way to score how well amino acids get into our system, you know, and what they would classically do is they make you eat something. They dig through your poop and they calculate how much of that protein was still absorbed. That's what's PDCAAS. And they've upgraded to something called the DIAS, where it's a little bit more sensitive because instead of digging through their poop, they dig out what comes out of the end of your small intestine. Because what was happening is within your poop is a lot of bacterial protein, because we have a lot of bacteria that inhabit our colon. So it was a less accurate way to measure protein availability for absorption. And so now they have something called the DIAS, which is the digestibility of indispensable amino acid score, the DIAS. So that's a new one. But regardless, I mean, what it shows consistently is whey protein, number one. Whey protein is the best way to get protein. If you want to go basically on what's really absorbable. And then we see following that, we see things like egg protein and then beef protein and pork and chicken and all those things. And then way down the list. And soy is actually a pretty decent protein when it comes to those metrics. Soy does contain things called trypsin inhibitors, which tend to, you know, limit that a little bit. And then you get into things like corn and wheat and all these other, you know, proteins, which are not well absorbed based on those scoring. Now, what I find is that, you know, I think, honestly, I think egg protein and dairy protein and beef protein are all great sources of protein. Now, the problem is a lot of people don't tolerate dairy for whatever reason. There's a lot of people have sensitivities to some of the like caseins and, you know, lactose and things like that. So it's problematic in that a lot of the things that come with it can be problematic. I think that, you know, eggs, same thing. Some people have problem, you know, eggs are a pretty common allergy and there's a lot of people that have sensitivities to that. So I still find that, you know, meat protein, probably meat or fish protein are pretty good. And then the problem with that is, you know, when you start going to things like chicken, and I rarely, if ever, eat chicken, it's not a bad source of protein. The problem is it's not a very good source of fat. And so you get into this, yeah. I'm just going to eat chicken breast. And what is, you know, I mean, from an appeal standpoint, it's like, I don't go look at a chicken breast in a store and start salivating, but if you show me a marbled steak, I'm like, wow, that's going to do it for me. Cause I think that the fat is incredibly essential. I mean, we have to have fat in the diet. We know that if humans get less than about 20% of their calories from fat, and this is even on a diet that includes carbohydrates, they start to run into problems. And, you know, 20% is not that much fat when you look at it on a per calorie basis, because we know that, you know, fat has 9 grams per calorie or 9 calories per gram rather. And, you know, carbs and protein tend to have 4-ish about. So, I think, you know, like I said, when it comes to muscle protein synthesis, another thing we see, there's studies out there that show that actually, again, dietary cholesterol has an impact, has a positive impact. And so when we have just protein without some of these other nutrients, whether it's the cholesterol, perhaps some of the, fat soluble vitamins, vitamin A, D, E, and K, you know, we might compromise. I think there's studies out there that's showing like directly comparing a diet where you feed people pure egg white protein versus egg white plus the yolk, where the protein is matched. You know, they each get 10 grams of protein because there is a little bit of protein in the egg yolk and people don't know that. But if they say exact amount of protein, 10 grams versus 10 grams, egg whites only or whole egg, the whole egg people do better. They do better with muscle protein synthesis. So why is that? What's in there? Because the same amount of protein, but clearly there's other ingredients in there, whether it's the fat soluble vitamins, whether it's the cholesterol. We know that that has an impact on muscle protein synthesis. In fact, there's actually studies showing higher cholesterol diets show more muscle growth. And it maybe it has an impact on the hormones. I mean, we know that, like, for instance, cholesterol is the backbone for many of our hormones, all the sex hormones. Vitamin D, for instance, you know, the progesterone, pregnenolone, testosterone, and all the other derivatives of that are based upon a cholesterol backbone.
I want to back up to something you said at the very beginning that's just been gnawing at the back of my head. You said when you went carnivore, full carnivore, you observed that you were able to work out harder, recover faster, and build muscle. Now, you're mid-50s, you're a little younger than me, but those are three things I want. I want to be able to work out harder, I want to be able to recover faster, and I want to be able to build muscle. Now, what you just described to me, those three qualities are touted as benefits of taking testosterone supplementation.
Yeah, they could be, I'm sure. I mean, you know, and just to be clear, I'm not a fan of testosterone supplementation. I don't take it personally. I think it's overprescribed. I think it's kind of a metabolic band-aid. I think most people that are on it probably don't need to be on it if they were to do the right things, diet, exercise, and that sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's,
My question is, not since you're not taking testosterone and getting the effects of testosterone supplementation, does it, therefore, that this at least implies that the carnivore diet itself is benefiting your beneficial hormone levels?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're probably seeing, you know, whether it raises or not, I've seen a lot of people with their testosterone, and a lot of people it raises their testosterone. Some people it has no effect. Some people it actually sees it go down, you know. And I don't know that it's isolated to the specific effects of testosterone or, you know, testosterone in the blood. Now, the reason I say that is because, just like we talked about, insulin and insulin resistance, there is such thing as androgen resistance. So we have receptors. Every hormone has a receptor, and every receptor, whether it's insulin or glucagon or testosterone or thyroid, has a level of sensitivity, which is modifiable, right? And so, like, there's a great paper from Stu Phillips from, I believe, 2018, where they looked at a bunch of 20-year-old college kids, you know, 20, 22, whatever they were, and they had them work out, and they measured all their labs. They looked at, you know, testosterone, free testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, DHA, DHEA, all these sort of androgenic, you know, muscle growth hormone, things like that. All these hormones that, you know, have a role on there. And they also did muscle biopsies on them, and they measured the androgen density, the androgen receptor density and sensitivity. And what they found was the only thing that correlated with muscle protein synthesis was the androgen receptor. Not how much testosterone was floating around the blood, but how sensitive that receptor was. That was a real clear correlate. Now, it's not to say that guys taking drugs, exogenous hormones, don't see that, because we know that that has an impact on our androgen receptor. And so things that are known to increase the androgen receptor sensitivity include exercise, exogenous hormones, which I'm not a fan of, meal frequency, actually less, I would call it almost intermittent fasting, not eating constantly seems to increase the androgen receptor. And then another thing called carnitine. Now, Phil knows that you get, where do you get carnitine from in the real world? You basically get it from red meat. I mean, it's in a few other foods, but I mean, where you get it in animal products. So there could be some argument made that, you know, you become more sensitized to androgens, perhaps. Maybe you might increase your sum a little bit. I mean, that might be occurring. The net effect, usually, not for everybody, but for most people, is an improvement in what I call testosterone function. Maybe not the level, but the overall function. Maybe their androgen receptor is more sensitive, but it usually looks like this. People get a little bit leaner. They put on a little bit more muscle. Their sexual function often improves with, you know, with erectile function and libido. There's another thing. There's a study in the urology literature that looks at, you know, they were looking at, this is for erectile dysfunction. They looked at comparing testosterone versus carnitine. You know, testosterone, you know, as we know, is a replacement hormone, and they found actually carnitine was superior for erectile dysfunction than even testosterone. So again, where are you getting carnitine from? You're getting it from a steak. So eating lots of carnitine has benefits. I mean, we know they have benefits on the brain. We know they have benefits on the health. It's vilified, you know, in the fact that there's something called TMAO, trimethylamine oxide, which is being, you know, the Cleveland Clinic is out there saying, well, TMAO levels are higher in people with heart disease, and therefore you should avoid choline and carnitine. Where do you get choline and carnitine from? Steak and eggs, basically. But there's a lot more nuance to that particular sort of thing. I mean, I'm certainly happy to talk about that, but that's something that's out there. But yes, I mean, in brief, many people, men and women, notice that maybe their overall either testosterone level or function of the testosterone, because I think, remember, it's dependent on the receptor as well, seem to often improve as their metabolic health improves, which makes sense. I mean, you know, you see, because you see a lot of guys that are just overweight, out of shape, and they're put on testosterone, and it doesn't really make a difference, because all they do is they get on, and it often, as long as they keep all this extra body fat, it just turns the aromatase enzyme just turns it into estrogen. So, I mean, they just kind of continue to fuel that. And so I think you really have to make those lifestyle changes. And again, this is a recurrent thing. There's no free lunches here. You can't just keep put on a magic pill. You got to make the lifestyle change. And I know the pharmaceutical industry wants to keep saying, we got this pill, we got this drug, we got this injection, and it's going to make you everything wonderful. But there's always a gotcha. And I think we'll see that with, I don't know what Phil's opinion on Ozempic is, but I think we'll see that with these GLP-1 agonists. I think we're going to see 3 years, 5 years from now, we're going to see some real potential train wrecks, but we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, both of us have seen it over and over in our careers now, the miracle drugs that, you know, turn into disasters. You know, yeah. I'm sure you, you prescribed a lot of Vioxx in your day.
Sure. And, yeah, it was, you know, it worked pretty well. I mean, it was a decent COX-2 inhibitor, and it actually helped people with arthritis. But damn it, you're killing people.
Exactly.
Oh, well, for the ones that don't die, it's pretty good, I guess. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, the discussion on carnitine kind of, you know, brings up one of the points that I think kind of gets debated. You know, is it what you're taking out of the diet or is it what you're putting into the diet? And, you know, in the end, you can't really separate those two. But I want to pivot a little bit and talk some about some of the work you're doing on improving and protecting, you know, access to meat. And I know you've been working with ranchers and some of the cattlemen's associations. Talk a little bit about that stuff that you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, if we make the assumption, and I, you know, like I said, I'm willing to make that assumption that meat is a health food, which I think it really is. Well, we need access to it, right? I mean, and, you know, as anybody who's not living on a rock has heard, well, you know, to save the planet from impending disaster, the cow farts are boiling the oceans and we got to get rid of the cows and we need to get everybody to eat more insects and soybeans and plant-based foods and, you know, that type of stuff. And we just need to cut back. Whereas I think the opposite is true. I think we need to cut back on the ultra processed foods and include more high quality proteins in the diet. And the other interesting thing is that a lot of us that do this, we actually consume far less food than the average person. We make far less waste. I mean, I can tell you I literally fill up a trash bag about once a week, you know, kitchen trash bag because I throw a couple bones in there and that's about it. There's nothing that maybe there's a little bit of plastic from the thing if I do that, but I mean, there's very little. But I think first of all, I've been trying to convince the cattle producers that number one, you're producing a health food. And I go to lecture these guys and they're like, what? Really? They don't even know that the food they're producing is actually literally reversing diseases in people. So we get them to sort of buy off on that. And, you know, I've been kind of pushing, you know, some of these big cattle organizations to start funding some research on the effects of meat on health and, you know, in the context of these carnivore type diets, because to me, that is the ultimate non-confounded way to do something like this. Well, if meat is bad for us, then a diet of pure meat should be awful. I mean, people should just be getting sick as can be. And of course, as you know, Phil, the exact opposite is happening. You know, we're seeing it anecdotally and it's growing. And now there's, gosh, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, even probably millions of people now have tried this. So we're trying to get research there. And so I'm in the middle of negotiating with, well, myself and several other people are negotiating a study to show the impact of a carnivore diet on, for instance, diabetes, which we know is, gosh, it works really, really well for that. At least that's been my experience. And so we're currently, you know, in negotiation with the Beef Checkoff or the NCBA, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, to do that. We've had, and I've got some researchers lined up that are just chomping at the bit to do this research. So I'm not a researcher myself, so I'm not going to throw my hat in that arena because I don't want to mess it up. So I want professional researchers to do this. So that's, you know, that's one of the things, that we're doing. You know, obviously I'm lobbying on social media, trying to just educate people that, one, it's healthy. Now, the other side of that is, you know, well, people say, well, maybe it's healthy, but it's bad for the planet and we need to get rid of that. And I think there's just a tremendous amount of information that would show that that's not to be the case. I don't think the time constraint of this podcast will be enough to go into that. But I mean, a lot of people are coming around to that as well. I mean, they're seeing that, we see like in the Netherlands where, you know, they're trying to shut down farms. The sad thing, and this is a sad thing, is that in the United States, you know, we're seeing all this backlash in the Netherlands about, you know, 3,000 farms having to close and Ireland having to cull 200,000 cows to meet their net zero climate goals for whatever for 2030. In the United States, in mid-1970s, we had 1.3 or 1.4 million ranches, cattle ranches in the United States. Today, we have under 700,000 of them. So in the last 50 years, we've lost nearly 50% of our cattle producers, or, you know, our ranchers. Now, some of that's been taken up by big corporations that have kind of taken over those, but we've had a net loss. I mean, for instance, our cattle population in 1970, again, was about 130 million. We're now down to about 90 million. So we've lost something like 40% of the cattle. The average American used to eat almost 100 pounds of beef a year. Now it's down around 56 pounds, 55, 56 pounds. So we've seen a 40, 30, 40, 50% reduction in the amount of beef that's being consumed in the population over the last 50 years. And, you know, we can see, well, what's going on with the health. You know, if we just look at the health numbers, I mean, the health numbers are abysmal. I mean, it's, you know, our obesity rates are, you know, they were 42% pre-pandemic. You know, post-pandemic, they're probably closer to, I don't know, 46, 47%. Soon we'll cross 50%, not just overweight, but obese. And that's quite an accomplishment, you know, to be able to do that. And so I think it's in everyone's interest that we figure this stuff out. And we don't just, fortunately, we've seen a massive rejection of the plant-based fake meats. I mean, we've seen those companies where they, you know, they're just, it's just the interest is waning in that, despite this massive, massive push and financial backing behind that. No one's buying that stuff. So at least people are saying, hey, I don't, one, it doesn't taste as good, and two, I'm just not buying it. And then, the cell-based ag has also got similar problems, which, you know, I've talked about many times, but I am trying to, as you know, I'm not an atmospheric scientist. I'm not anybody that has any kind of stuff, but I know a little bit about health. And so, and I can show receipts on that as far as, you know, patients we've helped. And so I think from my standpoint, I just want to show people that meat is a health food and we need to keep it in the diet and we need to, not demonize it and get rid of it for that reason alone. And I'll leave it to other people that are in the industry that can demonstrate the beneficial impacts or everything has an environmental impact. There's nothing we do that doesn't. I mean, the healthcare sector, Phil, if you don't know that, produces something where some up to 10% of our greenhouse gases in the United States. Cattle produce 2%. The healthcare sector produces 10%. I mean, I don't know. You can remember. You go in the operating room, and how many trash bags full of garbage do you produce every time you do a surgery? I mean, they're rolling like these big 55-gallon trash bags, 6 or 7, 8 of them out of the room with all the trash you create every time you do an operation. And that's just, you know, that's just all the stuff that goes into garbage, all these single use items. So if you can prevent, you know, a few of those surgeries, and I know we certainly can, how much do you save there? And just amount of pure garbage and all the fossil fuels that go into making that garbage, to making the products in the first place. So
Not to mention the pharmaceuticals, you know, and all the, you know, the plastics and everything that go into that manufacturing process. I mean, sick humans are definitely much worse for the environment than healthy animals are.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. It's a great way to look at that. And I think, you can't save the planet with a bunch of sick humans. And, you know, I think that's something that we have to get that message out there. And, like I said, anytime you get this, you know, monocular vision, and it's all this sort of black and white stuff. This is it. And you don't look at all the external things that go into that. Like I said, I mean, if we're looking at greenhouse gases, look at the healthcare sector, 10%. Well, what happens if I go on a meat-based diet, which impacts arguably 2% of the U.S. greenhouse gases, but I get out of the healthcare sector and I don't need the doctor anymore. I'm not going to the ER twice a year and I'm not on all these chronic meds anymore. Is the net effect of that positive? I think it probably is, you know, but no one's doing that calculation. But, you know, we clearly see, you know, there's a lot more, it's a lot more complicated than a simple, well, cows fart and therefore there's methane and therefore we need to get rid of all the cows. I can go into, you know, some of the, you know, with biogenic versus, you know, other sources of methane. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that, but it's not as simple as people are telling you, I suppose.
Well, Phil, you keep bringing on these super brains and making my brain explode. And I appreciate it. I really do. But I'm thinking about the transcription here. It's going to be a lot of fun going through the transcription. We're going to find out just how good our language recognition software is.
Exactly. But yeah, I think this really was a great masterclass, you know, little deep dive onto some of these nuances of the carnivore diet. You're not a hard man to find, Sean, but if people want to find you, where's the best places for them to do so?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you go to Rivero.com, I'm there every single day. I literally, you know, one of the things I've found is it's so important to provide community support for people. And so I do it every single day of my life. I'm on a Zoom call with 100 people, and I just, you know, we're talking to them. So if you want to join that, you can go to carnivore.diet or Rivero.com, which is our company, which we'll be launching very soon. I am on social media. I've got a YouTube channel, Sean Baker MD. I've got a Instagram account. It's Sean Baker 1967, which is the year I was born. And then I'm on Twitter at S Baker. No, sorry. Yeah. S. What is it? Yeah. S Baker MD. Capital S, capital B, you know, then AKER, and then MDs in capital. So that's where I am primarily. You can find me there and, you know, causing trouble, probably.
I love it. I love that you're causing trouble. There needs to be more trouble caused this way.
I think so too.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time, Sean. It's been fun listening to you. I didn't pay much attention in 10th grade chemistry, and I've been busy making up for that for most of the last five decades. So I appreciate the masterclass there. I heard things I'd never heard before, and that's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's so much we don't know. That's a thing. I mean, like I said, you can get into all the physiology and ins and outs of that, and I do sometimes, but I'm really kind of, I mean, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, hammer hit it, man. And to me, it's like, here's a stake and whack somebody over the head with a stake and their health gets better. So, I mean, it's kind of, cause it's all kind of a black box still, as far as I'm concerned. And I mean, I know it's fun to talk about this stuff, but I mean, I like to keep things simple, you know, in many cases. And I know because Phil wanted to talk into some more nuance and this stuff, but I mean, I think it's really just stop eating ultra processed garbage, start, you know, and this is the other thing is I think you have a lot more power than what you think you do. But if you're sick, chronically sick, and you're eating this ultra processed human pet food, you can't access that power. You got to get off that stuff. And I think that's, you know, I think that's just such an important, you know, message.
That's good stuff. I have one last question for you. I watched your video where you did 100 reps at, what was it, 325?
Yeah, yeah, deadlift the other day on Friday last week. Yeah, yeah. I was pretty sore.
I was going to ask you, are you still sore?
A little bit. My glutes got really, really sore. It was kind of funny. I've been training with weights for 43 years now, and every once in a while I'll do this one of these crazy workouts where I'm profoundly sore for a while, and it doesn't happen much on carnivore. I got to say, I really get sore, but I was sore from that one.
Oh my gosh, we talk about this at the end rather than at the beginning. Crap.
Well, you brought it up now, I was very sore, so far sore in fact that I had to have my significant, she had to put my socks on, my underwear on, my pants on. I couldn't sit out. I couldn't go to the bathroom for 3 days because I couldn't sit on the toilet. It was that sore. Fortunately, on carnivore, you don't make much waste, so I was fine. It's Tuesday before I go to the bathroom, and I did this workout on Friday. So it was kind of we were both laughing. I mean, I've been hiking on Sunday, but I was waddling. I was kind of like waddling up and down the hill, and because I couldn't flex my hips, you know, it was painful. So anyway, yes, that was a fun one.
Wow. We went from the sublime to the ridiculous here.
Yeah. No, it's always impressive what you're out there doing, and you know, you're still doing it at a high level, despite the fact that you haven't eaten any carbohydrates, which makes some people's head explode.
Well, but I mean, more and more people are doing it. I remember when I broke the world records on the rowing machine and people were like, you know, you're weird, you're one off, whatever, we don't believe you. And now literally thousands of people. In fact, I was kind of interested. I'm doing jujitsu now, and the all-time greatest guy who's ever done jujitsu, this guy's named Hodger Gracie, has just called me and said, hey, I'm going on carnivore, man. I feel great. It's the best I've felt in years. So it's kind of fun to see that. So we're seeing it even in the athletes. So it's cool.
Awesome.
Ooh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
certainly a lot that we'll have to bring you back again for some time. But we, it, I, keep up the great work. Definitely appreciate everything you're doing out there.
Yeah, likewise, you guys. Yeah, likewise, you, Phil, and keep doing what you're doing. And I'll be happy to come on. Just, you know, let me know and we'll do it again if you want.
All right. We got two surgeons keeping people from giving them any business by their what they're advocating in terms of diet. So I think that reeks of credibility. Plus, both of you guys look good. All right. This is the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. We drop a new episode every Tuesday. Hit that subscribe button, and we will talk to you next time.
Chances are you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't need to change your life and get healthier. So take action right now. Book a call with Dr. Avedia's team. One small step in the right direction is all it takes to get started. Contact us at ifixhearts.com/talk. That's ifixhearts.com/talk.